Okay. Can you hear me okay? Am I amplified? Good. First question. You mentioned sustaining the psychic field. Does Word in Life create a psychic field for us? It says, you mentioned sustaining the psychic field. Does Word in Life create a psychic field for us? And to me, I guess a psychic field, the question is it a place where you feel safe to explore meaning and be honest and respectful and open to depth? I don't know. Is it for you all? Is it? Great, great. One person mentioned to me, didn't write it down, but about the difference between atheism and humanism. And that's kind of an interesting distinction because I think a lot of atheists might talk about themselves as humanists. Not being an expert on this, but to me, they feel different in that an atheist is kind of an atheist, whereas a humanist is kind of a for humanity. You know, so I think it could be that a lot of atheists and humanists have similar beliefs, but those labels, at least to me, one is I'm not one of those theists. The other one is I'm pro-human. And I mean, back in the day, you know, in the Reformation and that period, there were a lot of Christian humanists. That was a respectable tradition. Of you're about Christian, but you're also very much pro-humanity. So that would be the difference for me, and that humanist does sound a little more positive. Atheist often sounds over against. And you know, I mean, I think there's so many examples, but I remember one time a woman said to me in my little rural church up in Washington, "You know, I got to tell you, I don't believe in hell." She said, "I just don't see why a loving father would throw his kids in the oven." And so that kind of summed it up, you know, I think in terms of... And so that was a case where she was kind of saying, this is the God I don't believe in anymore. The God with the oven going. But it was there for... Well, that's a whole interesting topic. But, okay. Atheism and belief in God are like the right hand and the left. If one is not there, the other isn't either. They need each other to be whole. So there's kind of a sense that I think it's more of a statement, but or, you know, I'll respond. But and you see it, you know, there's a whole wonderful thing we could have done with just scripture in this question. I mean, the person comes to Jesus and says, "I believe, but help my unbelief." You know, like within me there is both faith and doubt. Jesus on the cross says, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani? Why have you forsaken me?" You know. The Psalms are full of, as we know, of doubt. When people sometimes would come to me and say, "You know, I'm really feeling depressed, and I don't think God cares for me anymore," we'd talk for a while. But when it was appropriate, I would say, "You know, I'm going to take out Psalm 22, and I'm just going to have you read it out loud." And you read Psalm 22, and it's all about how I feel God has abandoned me. God isn't anywhere close. People are mocking me. I mean, it goes on. Huh? It has a nice ending. But if you want to read some good statements of doubt, just open the Psalms, you know. And in fact, when I was going to go to seminary, there was a pastor in San Diego, Michael Taxer. And Michael is a great guy. He was raised Jewish. And he'd been a dancer with Martha Graham, for those of you who know Martha Graham. And then he decided he really wanted to find faith while he was dancing. So he searched a lot. He got attracted to Presbyterianism. He went to San Francisco Seminary, became a Presbyterian minister, and said, kind of his thing to God was, "I love being a dancer, but I'll give that all up to follow you." But he got to seminary, and in the first year, they said, "We need somebody who's got dance experience to do some liturgy." And so he started doing liturgical dance at seminary. He ended up writing a book about it. And then his parish in San Diego, which was in Point Loma, he created a studio where they'd put on Broadway musicals and all kinds of dance things. So it became part of his ministry. But anyway, the point is that when I got to know him a little bit before I went off to seminary. And when I met him, and at one point he goes, well, look, if you're coming to seminary, you're going off to seminary, you're going to meet with me all through the summer, and I'm going to tutor you in Hebrew, and I'm going to teach you how to be a Jew, because when you go to seminary, they're going to turn you into a Greek. And that's terrible. Because he says, if you're Jewish, you can go out and say, God, I'm really angry. You can be honest. But if you're trying to be a Greek, you have to be very balanced and rational, and everything has to be kind of proper. He goes, seminary will ruin you unless I get to you first. So I remember that, because there is kind of a sense sometimes in the church that, you know, gee, if I have doubt, there's something wrong with me. I think it's deep in Scripture, I think. And a lot of it, the answer of Scripture is come and see. Just tell me how depressed you are. Tell me how distant you feel from me. But let's have a conversation. You know what I mean? So I think in Scripture, certainly doubt and belief, the disciples are full of that back and forth. The Psalms are full of it. And it's a strong tradition. This person says, I'm one of a certified healing touch practitioner in our church. We have no official recognition and are not included in listings of church services or activities. Have you any suggestions on how to present ourselves to the clergy and parishioners? It's interesting with this, the energy work, broad category, which I didn't know as much about until I went to hospice, where we had Reiki and healing touch and cranial sacral. But in the church, we had healing prayer. And there's some differences in each of those, but there's a similar foundation to them, in that there's a belief that there is a close to us as human beings, there is energy that can be healing, that if it's done with reverence and openness, can have a benefit on people's physical and emotional health. So I know at Goleta Presbyterian, Ernie and Allison and Alan, remember, we've had healing prayer. We introduced that, and that caught on quite well. But it had it's called healing prayer, right, Ernie? Right, we use that term. So a lot of it is vocabulary, you know. I mean, that's my sense of it. And as a pastor, I just would often be asked, can you sponsor this or that activity or group? And while at Goleta Presbyterian, you know, we were very open, at times I knew that certain kinds of things would cause concern and maybe appropriate. So I had to be kind of careful. I just know as a pastor, I'm familiar with that issue. And at La Casa as well, and at hospice as well, people would come in and want to do things. And I would have to decide, even if I respect the person asking me, how will this play with my larger group that I'm responsible to. But I think healing touch and Reiki and all those things are wonderful. And at hospice of Santa Barbara, it would even... one time, I remember there was a mom, a daughter, and a dog that came, and they discovered a terrible tragedy. And I think the dog had actually been close to where the sudden death happened. And the three came in for counseling, and the mom and the daughter each went to a therapist, and one of our great counselors is also a Reiki person who does Reiki on animals. And she took the dog for that appointment and did this kind of healing touch Reiki on the dog, which supposedly helped the dog. I don't know. But it's that kind of a thing. If these energies are there in the creation that have been observed for centuries, it's certainly there in Scripture. I don't necessarily think God was saying, can't use it on the animals, because all the animals are part of the creation. And that's kind of a tangent, I guess. But okay. Let's see. Yeah, I think those were the questions. So in terms of what I've got left, I was going to talk a little bit about the arts, just a couple of things, and then do a reading from Wendell Berry. Is there, Martha or Tom or Bob, do we want to take any more questions, or should I just keep going? Or?
Anybody has a question, please use the microphone.
I do want to say one person came up to me at the break. Okay. One person who came to me at the break and made a great point, which is, you know, in response to that question of 10 words about a first time you became aware, you know, she just said she couldn't really answer that because for her, there's been an uninterrupted sense of God's presence from birth all the way forward. And that's very real. I know a lot of people kind of feel like, gee, I haven't had this great experience, but I've always felt close to God. It's always been, my heart's always been at home there. So just wanting to affirm that if that's your experience, then that's, you don't have to have a specific moment in time.
I just have one question, and can you just tell me the difference between atheism and agnostic, an atheist and an agnostic?
I'd be open to other people's thoughts, but I think atheist is like I'm against theism. I'm not that. And agnostic is I'm not sure. You know, gnosis of course means no, like the Gnostics, and agnostic is I'm not sure. I'm open. I don't claim one way or the other. There's a terrible joke you probably all heard. It's like. Did you hear about, you know, the dyslexic agnostic who stayed up all night worrying or trying to decide whether or not dog existed? So sorry, but anyway, it's Bob. Did you have a please?
Yes, there was a question earlier about. The difference between an atheist and humanism.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I just want to point out that on the bottom of page 196, there's a quote there from a Greg Epstein, who was a friend of the author's. And I'd like to read that quote to you because, it, to me, it brings out the essence of this whole chapter of what it all means. It's, he says, and this guy is a humanist speaking, he says, if people only take one thing from my work, let it be the idea that an authentic, passionate, committed humanist, and yes, atheist, must accept the dignity of other beliefs. Some atheists want to erase religion the way religious fundamentalists want to erase humanism. My humanism is an embracing philosophy. It says, "It's let's understand ourselves enough to know why we disagree, then let's trust ourselves to care about each other and each other's work and work together towards common goals." So I think that's the major point of his chapter on atheism, is that if both atheists and religious people can accept doubt, as you were just talking about, and not focus on certainty, then we can have a dialogue that will bring us closer together.
Well put. Well put.
Well, it's been my understanding of atheism that it means not only don't you believe in God, the God of Christianity, but you don't believe in any higher power at all. And an agnostic feels there's something there, but they just don't know what. Mm-hmm. And in questioning a number of people who have considered themselves to be atheists, I've found out that what they're really saying is they're against the God that's presented by the churches and by the dogma in organized religion. And if you press them, they will really say, yes, I know there's something there.
Mm-hmm.
But they call themselves atheists, nevertheless. And I think that's a little sad because they're not. They're just like the rest of us. They're just wondering.
Yeah, I think when, insofar as we all, this is, everybody knows this well, insofar as we define, create our picture of the world based on what's in the media, we're kind of limited. The more we go by personal connection with people, the more realistic it is. And I think one of the things I love about interfaith work is, I remember talking to one Muslim woman, we were in a conversation, and somebody asked her about an experience she'd had, and she was saying, well, when my husband and I were first married, really wanted to have children, and we did everything we could, and it went on for several years. We tried all kinds of things, nothing happened. And then I just said in my prayers that I give it up. I guess Allah, I guess God, you just don't want me to do that, but I want to do your will, whatever it is. And then, of course, after that, she had three kids. And I thought, I've heard that kind of the same story, that kind of story in the church many times. You know, those kinds of stories. And if you just move the vocabulary around, it's there. And but I would never ever hear that on the news. That story of being with that person. And we probably wouldn't have had that conversation if we hadn't trusted each other to get to that point. You know? I might mention at La Casa, on that regard, I'll do a little infomercial here. In April, we do those Wednesday retreat days, and there's a schedule out there. We have our new website coming up maybe today or tomorrow. It's going to be really beautiful if you look at it. But our Wednesday retreat day in April is the Imam, Yaman Niazi, who's speaking here next week. And he's going to do a whole day on introduction to Islam. So often when I've ever been involved in those kind of talks, they're like short talks. But Yama and some women from his congregation are going to be at La Casa, free community donation kind of thing, from 9:30 to 3:30. We're just finishing an Islamic garden out at La Casa. In addition to all the Catholic gardens and the St. Francis garden, we now have the Buddhist garden, where that's to be, there's a space set aside for that. We have the Jewish Shalom garden. And I'll tell you, give you a little advance here, that when La Casa was doing its renewal and creating these spiritual gardens, there was the Jewish garden, the Shalom garden was there, and the Islamic garden was available for donors. And for those of you who know Mike and Ann Tobes in town, they thought, well, maybe we'll sponsor the Shalom garden. And then it turned out that another person, one of our board members, her husband had been Jewish, and she'd already beaten him to it. So it was Kathleen Berry underwrote the Shalom garden. And then a few weeks later, Ann Tobes called La Casa and said, you know, we've been thinking about it. We think we'll fund the Islamic garden. So you think about the most prominent Jewish philanthropist in town is just paying for this Islamic garden at La Casa. And it's inspiring to me. And so, anyway, I think probably all of you know La Casa pretty well, most of you. So La Casa continues to be, that's what it's always been in my mind, and that's what it continues to be. In April, on a last Sunday in April, we're going to do a John Muir Day. We're going to do our first annual John Muir Spirituality and the Environment Day. And we'll have different people from different spiritual traditions talking about the role of the environment in their tradition. So Yaman Niazi, the imam, will be there. A woman from the Unitarian Church, Buddhist speaker. And then Rabbi Steve Cohen from B'nai B'rith. Steve just did a big chunk of the Pacific Coast Trail before the movie Wild came out. And he and his wife did a shorter piece of the John Muir Trail last summer. So Steve's a very devout Sierras kind of guy. And he's going to be in the afternoon. He'll be talking about his own sense of being out of the environment. And then in early May, we're going to do a conversation for the common good on human trafficking as a spiritual crisis. And we've got a woman from Pacifica, Oksana Yakushko, who's head of their clinical department, a woman from Pacifica who spent a lot of research in India on human trafficking, and the director of the Rape Crisis Clinic in town about how that issue manifests itself here in our community. Anyway, so look at our website, or there's our brochures out there, but La Casa has always, to me, always been a place that's been a psychic field where so many good things can happen. Okay, I'll move to finish here. Are we good? Okay. To me, you know, organized religion may struggle to survive. The Presbytery of Santa Barbara, which has included these three counties for decades, after it has been splitting, and it's about half the size it was a couple of years ago because all the conservative churches have left to join a more conservative brand. And so having been a pastor for 27 years, and all of you are involved in churches, you know, organized religion is, which has been so much a part of many of our lives, it's a challenge of doing things. But the point is, to me, the hunger for the divine is inextinguishable. Alfred Whitehead said, life refuses to be embalmed alive. And I think I think God does too. I think God refuses to be embalmed alive. And whenever institutions don't let God flow, God will find ways to flow. And so back before I found my faith, when I fell in love with classical music and opera, which to me was a kind of a transcendence, it's been interesting to follow it. Because right now, in our time, I don't know if you heard of this gentleman, Arvo Pärt, composer. Arvo Pärt is Estonian, and he was, during the Soviet time, he had to write a very prescribed kind of very dissident modern music for some films and other things. And then he had a spiritual turning, and he withdrew from composing, and he... when he came back, he created a whole style that's the first time I heard it, I felt like, you know how you'd be sitting there, if you have dogs, and you'd be in your house, and the sudden dog would go, woof, because they hear something you can't hear. The first time I heard Arvo Pärt, I was like, what's that? Because that sounds like sacred music, you know? So Arvo Pärt became deeply involved in his Orthodox, his Eastern Orthodox tradition. And he has, been, the last 15, 20 years, has been writing all kinds of pieces. Many, many films use his music for film scores. And it's all got a sacred basis, whether it's instrumental or spoken choirs. This last October, they had his 70th anniversary. They sold out Carnegie Hall two nights, completely dedicated to his music. And they also did the Museum of Art in New York, sold out, totally dedicated to his music. He's the most performed living composer in the world, and it's deeply spiritual music. And I don't mean spiritual like cheesy. I mean stuff that's like, wow. And it's simple. It's just compelling. It's really fascinating. It's the music critic for the New Yorker in his book talked about how in hospice work sometimes some Arvo Pärt music people just in the dying process just want to hear it. Nobody knows why exactly, but there's something really profound about it. The most performed American living composer is John Adams. And John Adams has been composing for about 20 years. In the last, he's the guy up there, and to his left is, sorry, it's not a big enough picture, a guy named Peter Sellers, not the old British comedian. But Peter Sellers is an opera producer and opera director. He's on the faculty at UCLA, and he does arts festivals all over the world. At the anniversary of Mozart's birth, Vienna put him in charge of the whole festival they were doing. But in recent years, John Adams has done two big works. One of them was El Niño, The Child, and it's about an hour and a half oratorio. They'd asked him to do an opera, and he said, you know, when I was a kid, I grew up loving Handel's Messiah. I'm going to write an oratorio. So he wrote this piece that uses scripture texts from Matthew and Luke, some apocryphal texts, some Latin American women's mystical poetry. And it's this extraordinary piece. In New York recently, they've been performing Bach's Christmas Oratorio, Handel Messiah, and John Adams' El Niño sometimes. And so when I saw it twice in L.A., the performers were down here singing. Orchestra at Disney Hall was there, and behind was a screen with a video. And at least in one of the productions, the video had no commentary on it, but it was kind of reflecting what's happening in the story. And it was as if the whole Christmas story was played out among a young Latino couple in L.A. in the modern time. So you're hearing... Joseph and Mary doing this, and meanwhile you see this young Hispanic couple trying to find a place to stay in East Los Angeles. Sold out, you know, big time. That's sacred music. That's going back. It's going back to the Gospels, and it's in a church. It would blow the roof off of a church. It's very vibrant music. So he did that, and then just a year or two ago, he premiered his next big piece, which is The Passion According to the Other Mary. And it's the whole passion of Jesus told through Mary Magdalene. And interspersed in it are writings from Dorothy Day and other modern contemporary writers. It starts out with the Mary Magdalene character with a screaming in a jail cell, being with there's a heroin addict who's coming off of heroin in the L.A. jail. The costumes they did for this when it premiered in L.A., they went down to the garment district in L.A. and bought, like, used clothing from that to construct the costumes when it was done at Disney Hall. And I'll show you a little clip here, just a two-minute thing of it was at English National Opera. So this is a little blurb from English National Opera for The Gospel According to the Other Mary.
I thought it was absolutely incredible. I really, really loved it.
If you want to hear something actually just sonically beautiful, go. I still feel a bit speechless about it, actually. I still feel like I'm getting it together in my head. It was stunning.
It has so much to offer that a normal opera doesn't.
Visually and theatrically, it's just so vibrant. So if you were wanting to go to the theatre and see something that was moving and contemporary and had a soul, then go.
So for me, as somebody who tries to bridge, well, my life is trying to work all this stuff out. When I go to L.A. and see these kinds of things, when I see these things happening in New York, it just fascinates me that in secular culture, this very high-level classical culture, which is largely agnostic, if not atheistic, and mixed in with some people of faith, that the two greatest performed composers right now are Arvo Pärt, that's writing from an Eastern Orthodox mystical point of view, and John Adams, who would himself would say he's agnostic, but he keeps being drawn to these stories, the birth story of Jesus and the passion story, but seeing him in completely new ways. And there's that sense in which I like it, because it's the sense of it's indestructible, no matter where our culture comes and goes. Okay, so I'm going to close with this reading from Wendell Berry's novel, Jaber Crow. Have any of you read Jaber Crow? A few people? Okay, just one or two. So Wendell Berry is an amazing guy. He is a poet. He's probably in his 70s, 80s now. Grew up in rural Kentucky. Educated at NYU. They offered him a professorship. He didn't really like urban people. Went back to a little town because he just liked rural towns. And so he's been writing essays and poetry ever since, based in Kentucky. 15 years ago, maybe, he was part of an environmental poets series that came to UCSB. Gary Snyder was there 1 week, and another time it was Wendell Berry. And Wendell Berry, I'd seen him speak before when I was in the farming area up in Washington. And I don't think he wears overalls, but it almost looks like he wears overalls, because he's a farmer, and they grow tobacco. It's a cash crop. But he writes eloquently of rural values. And he came out and he read a little excerpt from Jaber Crow, and then there was question and answers. And he's a real introvert, so you can just tell he's like, oh, when can I get out of here? But somebody said to him, you know, based on all you've said, don't you think that in high school, students should be required to learn gardening? And I thought, oh, he'll probably say that's the case. And Wendell Berry looked for a while and he said, no, they should read Homer in the Bible, because they need to know the problems they're dealing with aren't new. And this very environmental crowd at Campbell Hall was like, what? But it's that sense that these issues, even the environmental issue, which he writes about a lot, these are deep issues of the human spirit that have been going on. You know, the light and dark in us. You know, plumbing gets better, but these issues. So this is his novel, and he imagines this barber in this little town of Kentucky, and living his decades of his life. And in this one, I was reading this one summer, And I was at UCSB at the Rex Sin Pool, and I was reading it. And as I read this, this to me, I got emotional, because to me, this captured why I loved being a pastor. And in the midst of all the things of atheism and humanism and fights and denominations and everything else. And in this chapter, he's talking about how in this little town, these seminary interns would come out to preach, and these young guys would preach, and they talk all about most people are probably going to hell because they're too materialistic. And all these farmers and everybody are sitting there listening because they can't afford a regular preacher. But then later in the day, the pastor would be having his fourth serving of chicken and pie in the materialist table of the farmers, kind of a thing. But he said, I'll read two parts. In Port William, more than any place else I had been, this religion that scorned the beauty and goodness of this world was a puzzle to me. To begin with, I didn't think anybody believed it. I still don't think so. Those world-condemning sermons were preached to people who on Sunday mornings would be wearing their prettiest clothes. Even the old widows in their dark dresses would be pleasing to look at. By dressing up on the one day when most of them had leisure to do it, they signified their wish to present themselves to another and to heaven looking their best. The people who heard these sermons loved good crops, good gardens, good livestock, and work animals and dogs. They loved flowers in the shade of trees, and laughter, and music. Some of them could make you a fair speech on the pleasures of a good drink of water, or a patch of wild raspberries. While the wickedness of the flesh was preached from the pulpit, the young husbands and wives and the courting couples sat thigh to thigh, full of yearning and joy, and the old people thought of the beauty of the children. And when church was over, they would go home to heavenly dinners of fried chicken, it might be, and creamed new potatoes, and creamed new peas, and hot biscuits, and butter, and cherry pie, and sweet milk, and buttermilk. And the preacher and his family would always be invited to eat with somebody, and they would always go, and the preacher, having just forsworn on behalf of everybody the joys of the flesh, would eat with unconsecrated relish. And then the chapter ends with in addition to being the barber in town, he's the janitor at the church. So sometimes he'll just sit at the back of the church. And this is how he ends this chapter. One day I went up there to work. Sleepiness overcame me, and I lay down on the floor behind the back pew to take a nap. Waking or sleeping, I couldn't tell which. I saw all the people gathered there who had ever been there. I saw them as I had seen them from the back pew, where I sat with Uncle Orthy, who would not come in any farther, while Aunt Cordy sang in the choir, and I saw them as I had seen them from the back pew on the Sunday before. I saw them in all the times past and all the times to come, all somehow there in their own time, and in all time, and in no time, the cheerfully working and singing women, the men quiet, reluctant, or shy, the weary, the troubled in spirit, the sick, the lame, the desperate, the dying, little children tucked into the pews beside their elders, the young married couples full of visions, as old men with their dreams, parents proud of their children, grandparents with tears in their eyes, pairs of young lovers attentive only to each other and on the edge of the world, and the grieving widows and widowers, the mothers and fathers of children newly dead, the proud, the humble, the attentive, the distracted. I saw them all. I saw the creases crisscrossed on the backs of the men's necks, their worked, thickened hands, the Sunday dresses faded with washing. They were just there. They said nothing, and I said nothing. I seemed to love them all with a love that was mine merely because it included me. When I came to myself again, my face was wet with tears. So beneath all the debates and everything, it's the sanctity of life, you know? Thank you.